So I'm going to give a brief introduction, and then we'll bring Nemo back up here. But you can stay where you are for now. Just have a little beverage, relax, okay? So I think I shared when I first came out that I met Nemo up in Berkeley or Santa Clara at Nipun's house, I think, and got to know him a little bit then. And then when I was in India a couple of years ago, we really connected then, went to the slums with Nemo several times. And I have to tell you that going into the slums with Nemo is like going into the slums with Jesus, because people love you there. You know, you're just like a celebrity. People just rush to you, and he's so loving and so friendly, and I just so admired that about him. And then this past year when I went to Jordan, I was very excited to learn that Nemo was going to be there doing a concert and that I was going to get to sing with him. Nemo was sort of a rock for me in Jordan. Whenever we would be in a crowd of new people, I'd say to him, sit next to me, sit next to me. I have a little social anxiety. Sit next to me. So as you can see from his singing and from his presence, he's just a beautiful, beautiful soul. I titled the service Inshallah because that means, say it again in the real translation, Hugh. God, Inshallah. If God wills. Yeah, it's like thy will be done, if God wills, in Arabic. Because Nemo will often end conversations where we're making plans, where we'll go, Inshallah, if God wills it. So it seems like that's part of how he lives his life. And let's find out more about that as we bring him to the stage. Moving you a little farther away so we're not sitting on top of each other. There we go. So, Nemo, it's so good to see you.
It's so beautiful to be here.
Yeah.
Knowing that my last memory of this place was crying with joy.
Yes.
You know, having our 17 children from those communities that Bonnie was sharing about actually be here and share and love and feel your guys' love and presence and of our horses and our animals. And what a magical
experience. I forgot to mention that. So Nemo was part of the driving force behind the 17 children that we brought from India who did their show, and then they had a church service, and we also had, because we often do, we had a farm animal. There are no farm animals today, unless you want to count the rabbits that are outside. So you were not always working in India in these underserved communities. Tell us what you were doing before that.
Yeah, well, before that, you know, I went to business school, and I had this vision from high school that I wanted to be like CEO of Warner Brothers. I have a passion for entertainment, and so I chose to try to bridge the two. And after college, I was working in New York, trying to, you know, hone up my corporate skills so that I could eventually get where I wanted to be. And I pursued this kind of career of music, and then I had an animation studio eventually that I got pretty good amount of funding for. But it was in that point, I think, that I didn't feel good inside, and I was like so happy that even though everything on the outside was kind of nice and you know, hunky-dory in a way, I was listening to something, or something forced me to listen, and mm-hmm. I think it was through different elements of suffering that I went through in my life, mm-hmm. That said, you have to listen to this voice, and it led me to wanting to change it up and close everything, quit everything, give away everything I had. And I've been now at the ashram, the Gandhi ashram, for the last 10 years, and it's just been the most beautiful journey so far, you know, of learning and growing as a human being.
Was part of that suffering 9/11? Because I believe you mentioned when we were in Jordan that you were living in New York near the financial district during 9/11.
I lived a block away from the trade centers. I worked in, I mean, there's the two twin towers, but there's seven trade center buildings, and I worked in the World Financial Center. At that time, our building also got half demolished, and life changed after that for our whole world, for all of us as Americans, but also for a lot of us that were, closely hit. And it really shifted the way, kind of saw life. Mm-hmm. And I think to realize, like, to ask myself, what am I really doing with this life? Because I don't know how long I have. Mm-hmm. You know, that question really came stronger mm-hmm. after seeing everything happen in front of me. You know? Mm-hmm.
So when you ask that question, and you may notice that I'm very much veering from the questions I told you I would ask, but you're doing great. So, yeah. So when you ask that question, what am I doing? What What did you want to do instead? Like, what was the driving force? What was the inspiration or the vision that you started developing for your life?
Well, I think it's a great question. At that time, I was working at a financial company, mm-hmm. And I was doing well, but yet when I rooted at it, I was like, what am I actually doing mm-hmm. here, making money and serving this company that. His ultimate goal is to obviously just make more money. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was like, I don't know what the root of what I'm doing is here. So I think my first step was to follow my heart, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which was to quit and to pursue my passion of music. Uh-huh. And that's what that was my first kind of entanglement in kind of like moving away. Uh-huh. But then as I kept asking myself that question, what am I really doing? Then it also moved away from that. Because I realized that pursuing my passions, in my story, was an ego-driven thing. Mm-hmm. Music was being an artist and entertainer and making money. And so then even the animation studio, I realized, was also something it wasn't fulfilling the root cause, which mm-hmm. was, how can I be of service while I am here, was the question I think that was leading me to.
Ah, nice.
And so then I felt like, how do you know, get to that space of being an instrument of small?
Yeah. Boy, that's really, you know, lately in my own spiritual development, I've been asking that question a lot, too, and it seems like that is the solution for everything. Just so you know, how can I be of service while I'm here? And not only here, but, you know, when I do these long flights, like to Jordan or India, I used to just dread being on a plane, and now I see it as like a little ashram. Where I just look for opportunities to serve, and when the 16 hours is up, I'm like, I'm not ready yet. I don't want to leave. Circle around the airport a few more times, right?
So how do you find yourself serving there?
Different things. I often sit next to somebody who doesn't speak the same language as me. I often sit next to somebody who's too big for the seat and has trouble dropping. You know, when they drop something, they can't pick it up, so I pick up. Small and things. I just little things like that. And often if somebody sits on a plane and they're too big for the seat, they enter grumpy, and I make it my life's mission in that 16 hours to get them to smile at something.
I think that's it's so powerful, because that's it.
Yeah.
Which is like, how can we spread, when we say how can we spread love,
or yeah.
it's love in action in these small ways.
It is
And
that.
It changes the energy field.
Yeah.
Which transforms things at a much bigger level, which we don't need to know how it does,
right.
But it does.
It changes.
The ripple effects are big.
Yes, it changes in a different energetic, and we just have to keep doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I know this is supposed to be about him, but here I am babbling away.
I like this yeah, way. This
yeah.
way better.
But, you know, once I got back from Jordan, one thing that I discovered, I mean, we certainly both did a lot of service while we were there, but, you know, the plane and the airport were really such an ashram feel for me. And then I'm like, oh, look how you're limiting your intensity of service to a plane. Why can't it be in the grocery store?
Yeah.
Why can't it be at the DMV? You know, why can't it be anywhere? You know, and just having that capacity to just, instead of asking, what am I going to get from this, or what do I need from this, what am I going to give from this? I don't practice it 100%, but
There's one thing that the visual that comes to mind as Bonnie shares, that is like wherever we walk in our day, mm-hmm. imagine there being like some little pixie dust that follows us, right? And gets dropped on the ground. And at the end of the day, you take a kind of telescopic or this view from this top, and you realize everywhere you've actually gone. It could just be in your house one day, but it could be to the grocery store, it could be to work, it could be to church. And that is our real estate to play in, to give love to.
Yeah.
That's what we have access to every day.
Yeah.
And imagine all of us, all 200 of us here, and then you look at the pixie dust from all 200 of our day's journey, and if we're all having this intention to just break out of it a little of our comfort zone and to touch, to be kind, to sacrifice a little more, how does that change our community?
Yeah.
Just us here.
Yeah.
So it's magical that practice.
Yes, it's so inspiring. And yeah, I love the image of everybody spreading their pixie dust when often... So I'm going to get gross here, because that's what I do. Often, instead of, you know, you could either spread pixie dust or you could spread, like, dandruff or something, right? But what if we were all just to commit to whatever that means for us? And my way doesn't need to look like anybody else's way or Nemo's way, but just to spread that light, that gold, that glitter, that pixie dust wherever we go. And then I love your song, Planting Seeds. We don't need to see the results, you know? It's just, it's like people building the cathedrals in 1200. They never got to see the results, but they put one brick after one brick after one brick. We drop one pixie dust after pixie dust after pixie dust, and somehow, as you said, on a higher level, this higher order of wholeness emerges, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what you do now. Like, what I know you're here visiting your parents for a while, but what do you do like in your regular work cycle?
Yeah, well, I think 6-7 months of my years in the Gandhi Ashram, where Mahatma Gandhi started this community space after moving back from South Africa in India, and we're luckily centered there. We work in underprivileged communities, which are really tough environments. I think the ones maybe are, when we came, we shared a little about it with our children. But we serve in various ways. We have a nonprofit there. We have 100 full-time staff members, mm-hmm. and then a few of us long-term volunteers that are helping, run the organization. And it's so dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I love about life there is, I think when I was living my other life, I remember it being so like Monday through Friday, but as an entrepreneur, you're also like constantly, you're thinking of the days and the time, and over there, you just kind of get lost. Mm-hmm. And it could mm-hmm. be working with our children, it could be visitors coming, it could be groups coming, wanting to get seeds of inspiration for their organization, mm-hmm. Meditation, and the spiritual journey is so important, part of the process. So there's, the day is so unique and dynamic, at least in the lens that I get to have. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the other 5 months, I'm getting a chance to go around the world, and like we did.
Yeah.
And try to just be of service in small ways wherever I'm invited to bring music. A lot of schools. Mm-hmm. I go to a lot of elementary schools across the world, and I love children. I am a child, and I was just having a conversation about that with a friend about how I forget where somebody, yes, a dear here, just how important it is for us to never lose that inner child, you know.
Right.
So yeah, life is good.
Yeah.
And it's been a blessing, and in here with mom and dad for the next few weeks before I head back to India.
Yeah. So I had the experience of walking into the slum communities with you, and I said it was like walking into the slums with Jesus, which I think might have embarrassed you.
Yeah.
but
not very likely.
Well, we don't really know what he was like, so, yeah. You know. Yeah, but
he was cool.
He was cool, yeah. He's a rapper. Yeah. Maybe he was a rapper too, you know. Who knows? But why do you think people resonate so strongly with you? Why do they flock to you when you walk into the slum community?
I don't know if that's the case for sure, but
I saw it in Jordan too. I think it's universal.
What I do realize is that the families that I've had a chance to serve with in the communities maybe are used to seeing the world from two lenses. Like, we are here, and then there are people here helping us. And for me, I think it's so important in service that it is not like a looking down or looking up. Mm-hmm. It's like, those are my brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And I don't see them in any of, yeah, in practical terms, I go back to my apartment, and I go to sleep. But from a heart space, from a deep intention, mm-hmm. They really are my kids.
Yeah.
They really are my brothers and sisters. They really are my moms and dads.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's that cultivation, that practice that I want to keep working on, mm-hmm. to see that the world as my family, mm-hmm. and not to see any lines in between.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. So to see the world as your family and not to see any lines in between, whether they're rich, poor, homeless, have an appearance of an illness. I just visited a retirement home where people did not look like they were in great shape, but they were my brothers and sisters too. All of that.
Yeah,
yeah, that's beautiful. And that's part of it seems like the connection that gets stirred when you're with folks. The other thing that I've noticed about you, Nemo, again, veering very far away from
whatever I had planned to discuss, is
that your ability to tolerate chaos is incredible. Now you may not even call it chaos, but I know when we walked into that place where the refugee kids were staying, and you gave me the heart pins, and you said, hand them out, and afterwards I'm like, they're all over me, they're all over me. I don't know what to do. And you just took it and went with it. It was great. How is it that you handle chaos so well?
Good question. Maybe I'm not seeing the chaos.
It probably just like fun
I think,
to you.
I think it's always a good practice.
Yeah.
Right? When we're in that type of environment or energy, to try to really use it as an opportunity for our own growth, really, you know. And I feel like that for me is for sure. I mean, I think working with a lot of kids in India has been a great tool in that. But I think meditation for me has been my guiding light to try practice equanimity in all situations, whatever they be. And there are times I remember, I feel like I'm very aware of my sensations.
Right.
So when I do get into a space of turbulence, it's beautiful because it's like, wow, a lot of work still needs to be done.
Yeah.
And so it's just that life journey, right?
Yeah.
About constantly trying to, find that so that, you know, it could be more of a joyous and peaceful.
And thank you for putting words to that, because that's so much of what we teach here, is that you know, you are going to get turbulent, you are going to be stirred by chaos, and to look at that as a great opportunity to do more work. The other day I was having lunch with somebody, and we were talking about this universal condition called shame, and I said something to the effect of, you know, I've learned to be proud of my shame. Because, which is a paradox, it's an oxymoron, which, you know, is like my favorite thing in the whole world. But it's like if I'm seeing shame, it's a beautiful thing, because A, it helps me understand the shame of other people. If I'm seeing shame within myself, it helps me understand the shame of other people, which we are constantly projecting onto others, which is, I think, part of the reason the world is in sort of a state. But also, if I'm seeing shame in myself, I can celebrate that there's some work, some beautiful discovery of self-beauty and insight that needs to be revealed, or that's longing to be revealed. I wouldn't be feeling the shame unless something else wanted to emerge. So I offer that to all of us as a practice over the holidays, you know, when there's sometimes shame comes up over the Christian, Judeo-Christian holidays of, I didn't get what I wanted, you know, I gave the wrong thing, I'm too busy, all of that stuff. Yeah. It's just such a beautiful, you know, trying to be perfect in the holidays. It's just such a beautiful practice.
Yeah,
so thank you for
putting
words to that. Yeah.
Being vulnerable is great, and being aware of it.
It's the best.
And then it's not easy, but yeah.
I always tell people it's my superpower. Being vulnerable, yeah, being vulnerable and being willing to acknowledge when I'm being less than what the stereotype of a science of mind person should be doing. Right? This is how I feel. This is how I should be feeling. Well, let's go with how I actually feel and work with that.
I think the most powerful thing about it, aside from our own growth, is that we're opening it up to everyone around us,
absolutely,
to grow and to come to their own, and that's the versus being so perfect or trying to that becomes a very egoistic thing in and of itself, and all of us around each other feel like, oh wait, no, I gotta be like that.
Yeah,
you
know? Good
so
luck.
I think, thank you.
Thank you. And it also speaks to forgiveness, which to me is just the one of the antidotes for everything is forgiveness and vulnerability, you know, and humility. It's the 12 steps. It's so much that is so beautiful.
Yeah.
I could talk about this forever, but I did have another really specific question for you, which was not on the list.
Yeah, of course.
I
already deleted that email.
Yeah, good for you. I think I'm sitting on it, but I should just tear it up, yeah. So, you know, when you brought, it's for those of you who weren't here, Nemo brought Nemo and other leaders brought 17 children from this underserved community in India, and they did this beautiful show. And when they came into our center, it was like there was this influx of love. There was like this cloud of love that descended on the center. And we talked about that afterwards and said, wow, we want to continue to cultivate that in our youth. We're certainly working on it with our youth. But somebody was saying, somebody wise who knows a lot about children, was saying, you know, those children have had a lot invested in them, a lot of goodness invested in them. And we noticed even, like, when we went to Disneyland, you know, we'd get food and the volunteers would sit down and be like, hey, let's eat. And the kids would be singing in
prayer
yeah. singing a prayer before they ate. So tell us a little bit about the investment that that you and the staff and the volunteers have made in those children so that we can do the same and continue to deepen our investment.
That's a beautiful question. Yeah. When we do a tour like that, something at that level, all the audience that comes to a show, for example, they see the tip of an iceberg. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, if we didn't get visas, which they were bound to happen because of the magic of all our family, the journey would have been complete.
Uh-huh.
Just where we were.
Let me just clarify that. If the Indian government did not let you go to the States,
or the British High Commission didn't give us
visas,
we wouldn't have been able to come out here.
Right.
Which was a big tour that we had all collectively been planning.
Right.
And that would have been fine.
It would have been
except
fine.
Except for, you know, like all the investment and time that I felt bad that all our volunteers, that all of you had made. But it would have been fine because that was not the point. The point was to walk on a path together with these children, day in, day out, to not perform a show about this idea that we are a family of one, not to perform a show about courage and compassion and service, but to try our best to practice it mm-hmm. at a day-to-day level. So it's awesome because for me, the creative process is 40%. Mm-hmm. Though I know on a production level, it should be 99 to 100%. But for me, it's 40 to 30%. And 60 to 70% is how are we as human beings evolving together as a family as we create this production. And that involves, like you said, a family of mentors, mm-hmm. which was actually the first step for me and our trustees was let's pick a team that we feel could be mentors for these children. Before we picked the children, actually, mm-hmm. before the 17 kids were picked, mm-hmm. it was knowing that we needed a team of mentors that can help guide this journey. Mm-hmm. After we picked that team, then it was this selection of children, and then through that, it was a day-to-day process of, for example, small things. Like when we would have practice, I would say 40 to 50% of our time is creatively practicing. Mm-hmm. The other 50-60 is prayer, circle of sharing, cleaning, helping one another understand, because every kid has their story. Hmm. All of us have stories, but our children come from challenging spaces where their stories go a little deeper probably mm-hmm. in terms of, so how do we unravel and provide a safe space so all these stories are coming out mm-hmm. so that we can then start massaging each other's lives together, working with each other, and supporting this journey as brothers and sisters together. Mm-hmm. That's the journey.
Mm.
And then mm-hmm. we're growing no matter what, whether we perform a show or not. We are growing as human beings.
Oh, tell about after the show. You know, they used to run out and greet the public.
Oh,
and what happens now?
Yeah. So in the first few shows, which LA was our first show, we realized that, you know, after the performance, you know, the LA show, we had maybe, I think, 1,500 people there. And everybody was deeply touched. So they all want to connect with the kids after the show. And we want our kids to connect with the audience. But what we realized after a few shows was that that was also unhealthy for the grounding of the journey, because we're going to go back to our environments a month and a half later. And our children need to be coming back to India very softly, gently, instead of going off a cliff. Like seeing all of these amazing things and being treated like royalty and then being back, bam. So for us, one of a small practice was like after the show, right after the show, we're packing our bags. We're stuffing the costumes, all the props. We had, you know, about 12 or 14 big bags of props and costumes. and it was about organizing that as a team. And until we're all collectively done, then we can go out and connect with community and family. And it was awesome because the kids digested that. They understood why we needed to do that and how important it is for themselves and their own development and discipline. Mm-hmm. And that became a very powerful, it might have allowed them not to see as many people, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it gave them, I think, the type of ethics and work habits that they needed to take away something this for their, you know, in their lives.
Yeah,
so, yeah, that was really important.
It was really
small
important.
Things like that.
Yeah, one of the reasons I like you so much is that you really do a lot of things that are somewhat out of the box of normal thinking. you know, that many, many performers would not pack up 70 costumes and then greet the audience. You know, it's really wonderful.
Yeah.
I've got two more questions for you. Oh, we're running a little late, but I've got, we're almost out of time. But the first one is, we did call this service Inshallah, because you say that a lot.
Wow.
How's that showed up? Yeah, how has that shown up for you?
You know, it's like the two tallest buildings in the world fall down right in front of you, and you're running from these buildings. And the day before, I literally booked a flight to Milan for my sister and myself, that my company was treating me. I walked through the Trade Center courtyard, and there were summer concerts still happening. And I go home, and the next morning, I'm jolted with an earthquake, and then I look outside and everything. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? We have no clue what the next moment holds for us.
Right.
So I feel so audacious and arrogant to think that I'm going to be returning home today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I hope to see mom and dad later today, mm-hmm. but I can never say that I will see you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's just, for me, it's not even the right way to think. It's just what I feel in my heart, that it truly is not in my hands.
Right.
And so inshallah is in the Muslim world, it's so beautiful, because even in Jordan, you must have heard almost every sentence they finish with inshallah.
Mm-hmm.
They say, yeah, nice to meet you, see you soon, inshallah. And it's just like very, very simple for them to mm-hmm. realize that it's not up to us, it's up to God will decide whether we meet again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
mm-hmm.
and for me, I really appreciate that part of their religion and their thought process, and that kind of constant reminder that this is not in my hands. Look forward to seeing you, if that may be, if God wills, you know.
Yeah, and I see how much freedom. Some people might think that is a an act of obedience to some higher external being, but it's such a step into greater freedom, into the freedom to know that there's something greater than the smaller self that is orchestrating everything. And why do we really, why fight it?
Yeah.
Let's just go with it and see and see what wonders are wrought through that.
And it's so humbling. It's so humbling to constantly remember that we're such a beautiful, tiny speck of dust in this multiverse, and yet we are so amazing and magnificent all at the same time, but to make sure both of those go together.
Yes, they both go together. It's another paradox, my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Okay, one more question. Yeah. If you have any assignment or word of advice for this congregation as to how we can further
us, for all of us. Sure.
How can we support the values that you are putting out into the world through your work with the children, through the music, through your day-to-day interactions, through your sprinkling of pixie dust? How can we support that?
Wow, I love that. I feel like the definition of family for all of us many times has, you know, some type of boundary, naturally, mm-hmm. right? Because we're born in a home and we get to know that, and our community grows and that's our community. I feel like, how can we expand that circle a little more every phase in our lives?
Mm-hmm.
It could be a daily basis where we take an experiment to just smile at somebody that probably, you know, because it's not about that action, actually. It's about the expansion of our heart. And when that keeps opening, I feel like that's the work we can do.
Yeah.
What actions come out of that is, it doesn't matter. Because when the heart opens, the actions are going to be good for the world.
Yeah.
They're going to be good for other beings, other human beings, other communities. So I think that idea of how can we take little experimental steps to expanding what it means that our family is who, you know, I think that helps move us towards spreading love in subconscious, unconscious, and conscious ways, you know.
That's so beautiful, because as the heart opens, it leads to actions, and if the actions are from an open heart, then that leads to an open heart. You know, it becomes this circle.
Yeah.
And
that's
beautiful.
How I think violence or points of conflict are transmuted and transformed.
Yeah.
It's through that constant, like, nope, that's fine, I'm just going to shine my light here, I'm going to breathe deeply and let that person forgive.
Right.
And
yeah.
keep moving. And that's I think that's how the world is shifting and will shift constantly. And we are the warriors of that light.
You want to hear one of my spiritual secrets that nobody knows? except for maybe one or two people here in this congregation.
We're lucky.
Yeah. So yeah, don't tell anyone that. So when you have a dog that is frightened or aggressive, sometimes you put them in a thunder shirt. You know what a thunder shirt is? Mm-hmm. It's a wrap that you put around them, and it presses on their sympathetic nervous system. And so if somebody is in distress in my presence, if I can,
yes,
I will literally thunder shirt them and just hold them really tight. And if I'm not in a position to do that, I will psychically, mentally thunder shirt them and just hold them tight and know that love prevails. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. So you can, I give you, I bless you with the wisdom of thunder shirting.
All of us?
I bless you with the wisdom of thunder shirting. Yes. Nemo,
thank you.
This has been so wonderful. We're going to have you sing in just a minute, but I'm going to do a prayer first, okay?
Thank
so, thank you. God bless you.
God bless you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thundershirt.
Thundershirt. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. All right. Okay, so turning within. Let me just tear up this list first. Turning within and just trusting and knowing that there is this one perfect spirit, that is one family, that is the family.